This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
You last recorded with me, it must be 4 years ago, I think around 2021. But there was a couple of things that you said that stuck with me that I've never forgotten. I think I told you this in an email, and that was, it was just in passing, in fact, where you mentioned that you don't wear sunglasses and you don't wear sunscreen.
Oh, good. That's great. Yeah, I just get so upset. I almost can't stop myself from commenting when I see a mother with a little two-year-old. And the two-year-old is wearing sunglasses. I'm like, what is the matter here? This is so crazy. Because the kids really need the sunlight to help their brain mature. I mean, it's so important.
Exactly. But we have become fearful of the sun.
I know. I think the problem is that it's free. And pharma doesn't like things that are free and good for you, which is what the sun is. And so it claims you have to stay away from the sun, and that makes you sick, and then they can sell products. You know, I'm very cynical. They say, the dermatologist will say, stay out of the sun and take vitamin D, you know? And that's
crazy. Why would you take a pill when you can just go outside?
Take vitamin D as a pill instead of going out in the sunlight. I'm like, hello? It's crazy. I just don't, I can't fathom why they think that's a good idea.
I've had this conversation over the years now a few times with various friends about, you know, sunscreen and sunglasses. And something that, you know, comes up is, well, do you have peer-reviewed science? And I don't. But I must also say the COVID era has taught me not really to trust peer-reviewed science anyway.
It's
the entire system can't be trusted.
No, I agree. There is so much censorship going on, and it's so difficult to get things published that are especially if they go against pharma. You know, watch out, because pharma really guards its products very carefully. And if you're going to criticize its products, show them in a bad light, you know, you can't get it. It's really hard to get that published. Yeah. I mean, I was actually just sort of experimenting on myself because I wasn't sure. It just didn't make sense to me that the sun would be bad for you. I mean, I generally like things that are really natural, you know, and the sun is there and it's a source of energy. You know, the plants can't live without the sunlight. They use the chlorophyll. They turn carbon dioxide into organic matter using the sunlight as a catalyst. And we use the sunlight too in really important ways beyond the vitamin D, I believe. And so I just believed that, and so I just lived that way, and I didn't know what would happen to my eyes as I got older, right? Like, would I have all kinds of eye problems because I was getting abused by sunlight? Here I am, 77, I don't have any issues with my eyes. I've been to the doctor recently, not even cataracts, and most of my friends my age have already had cataract surgery.
Do you think that's related to wearing sunglasses?
I do. To not wearing sunglasses. That's what kept my eyes healthy.
Hmm. So here in South Africa, we have what's called the Kalahari Desert. It's just north, sort of alongside Namibia, just above the country. It's a huge, huge desert. But there's a wonderful game park that we went to. And naturally, with so much sand, you know, and so much sun, this was, for me, a great opportunity to test this. And so I said to her, to my wife, I'm not going to wear any sunscreen for this entire trip. And I'm only taking my sunglasses for those moments where the sand is just reflecting the sun just a bit too much.
Yes.
Because I think in some instances, if you can't get out of it, like if you're driving in a particular direction and the sun is setting and you can't actually get away from that glare in your face, I would argue that that's probably okay. I'm not sure. What do you think of that?
Well, even then, I mean, I have to turn the visor down because the sun is coming at me and I can't see, you know, if I'm driving. But I don't have sunglasses handy. I just deal with it by blocking the sun with the.
Right. Yeah. Well, I will say that we did that entire trip in the desert, and I didn't wear any sunscreen and I didn't get sunburned.
That's so great. Well, you have pretty dark skin naturally. I think it's really crazy, you know, dark skinned people wearing sunscreen doesn't make any sense to me, because you have that natural protection from the dark skin, the melanin in your skin.
Now, that's an interesting thought, Stephanie. So I mean, my ancestors come from Europe, but, you know, because I'm African, I have a more olive skin, I suppose. But in sort of more Scandinavian areas, people are exceptionally white.
Now, yes, I mean, and that's also because they're up north. Actually, it's interesting because people who live, whose ancestors lived in a place that has a lot of sun tend to be dark. And then people who live in places up north tend to be light. And that's actually a genetic evolutionary process because you want to get as much sun as you can when there's very little to be had. So people who live up north have very light skin in order to be able to absorb more sunlight. But if you put someone like that in, so for example, in Australia, there's a lot of light-skinned people live in Australia and there's a pretty intense sun. Could be tricky there, I think, because your ancestry isn't supporting living where you're living. So I think you do have to be careful in that respect. If you're in a place that's really sunny, like at the equator, and you came from ancestors that lived up north, then maybe you're not equipped to deal with extreme sun. So I certainly don't think you should just burn. You know, and some people say, I can't tan, I just burn. And certainly it's not good for you to burn your skin to the point of peeling, you know.
But you don't need to wear sunscreen. You can do what the Arabs do, and you can wear, you know, long cotton outfits.
And that's much better, yes.
Because if you think about it, what is sunscreen? It's some sort of chemical concoction that you're rubbing into your body.
It's got nasty stuff in there. It's got aluminum, actually, and it absorbs through the skin, and aluminum is extremely toxic. So, I hate sunscreen, actually. I really feel it's a big mistake.
Do you think there is a link between skin cancer or cancer in general and sunscreen?
Well, it's interesting because actually people who have breast cancer and who are and in the summertime get a lot of sun exposure, they do better in terms of dealing with the cancer. The sunlight helps them to deal with the cancer. People think of the sun causes cancer and they stop there, but the sun actually protects from cancer, from all kinds of cancers. And then if you have cancer, it's a good idea to get a lot of sunlight to help you heal the cancer.
Do you think the sun can cause skin cancer?
Yeah, I think it probably can. And especially, by the way, if you're exposed to toxic chemicals. And that's one of the things I'm concerned about with glyphosate, which, you know, I have my book here. See if I can hold it up. Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and the Environment. So glyphosate disrupts the shikimate pathway in the plants and also in the microbes in your gut. And the shikimate pathway produces aromatic amino acids. And those aromatics are precursors to melanin, the skin tanning agent. So I think when you have a lot of glyphosate exposure, your melanin levels go down. And that's why you can't tan, too, because you don't have enough melanin. That's because the melanin is sourced from the pathway in the gut that's disrupted by glyphosate.
So what you're saying is that the sun can cause cancer.
And especially if you're exposed to chemicals like glyphosate that disrupt your natural ability to protect yourself. I mean, that's the trick. The toxic chemicals are really twisting our minds because they are causing problems that shouldn't exist if you're just living naturally. Your problem exists because you're exposed to the toxic chemicals, which are disrupting your natural mechanisms to handle the situation.
What did people do 1,000 years ago? What were the Vikings? I mean, they were Scandinavians. What were they doing? They were in the same sort of sun.
Right. I mean, people in the old times were outside all the time, you know, and even the Africans in the heat of the Sahara Desert, you know. I mean, sunscreen didn't exist back then, or sunglasses, I'm sure. They just went without, and they were outdoors most of the time. So how did they cope? I mean, that's why I feel these things are weird, to say that this is natural, to slabber yourself with sunscreen and to wear sunglasses, that's natural. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm very much into natural, you know, and I don't even like to take supplements. There's a lot of issues with supplements. And I don't take any pharmaceutical drugs. You know, I'm like really pure, but then I'm happy to expose myself to the sun.
So one of my guests is a gentleman by the name of David Raznick, a fantastic scientist in the field of cancer and HIV AIDS. And he actually stated that cancer, in his view, didn't really exist 1,000 years ago.
That's interesting. Right. But as I said, they didn't have glyphosate back then. Yeah, I think the chemical industry is a nightmare. I really feel like we are down a very diabolical pathway right now as a species. And we have this incredible power in the chemistry lab to make all these exotic things. And then we feed them to people, you know, we create all these exotic drugs and all these herbicides and insecticides and fungicides, you know. And then we don't mind eating the food that's contaminated with all these things. And anything that's not natural to me is dangerous, any chemical. And we are going wild with these chemicals. There's so many new ones appearing every day, you know, and with inadequate testing for sure of what that chemical might do to the body. And when people study foods, you know, there's all these papers that study different foods and different kinds of fats and everything. They never worry about what are the toxic chemicals in those different choices. So if you have two different fats that you're experimenting with, one of which is contaminated with glyphosate and the other one isn't, and you're looking at whether saturated versus unsaturated, you're missing the point, because the reason why the one is not doing well is because of the chemical that's in it, not because of the kind of fat that it is. So they get all mixed up on these. Nobody can figure it out with the fats because they're not paying attention to this aspect of the fat that's more important than the fat itself, which is what kind of toxic chemicals are in. A big issue with foods is whether it's, to what degree is it processed? And you want to have minimally processed foods in your diet. I mean, I actually have a whole profile of, we have all these different people who have different opinions about diet. It's so amazing. In fact, there's a group right now that I'm in. In email discussion where there are people who think that vegetables are awesome and you should be vegetarian. And then there are people who think, oh, vegetables are terrible and you should only eat fats, you know, and they're fighting with each other. Each one is trying to make their case why they're right and the other one's wrong. It's so interesting, you know, that you've got all these diets and nobody can figure out which one's right. Even after all these years and all these papers, we still don't know, right? It's amazing. I mean, I have my own opinion, and I can tell you what I eat and what I believe in. And so number one is no chemicals, certified organic, absolutely number one. Number two is fermented foods, and I really love dairy. Fermented dairy is fantastic. And high-fat dairy, not low-fat dairy. I never have bought low-fat dairy or even, you know, low-fat, non-fat, I won't buy it. My whole life, always fat in the dairy. And I love cream, you know, whipped cream, ice cream, yogurt, they're all good. And butter, of course. Butter is fantastic. And so I like dairy a lot. And I like high-fat diet, and particularly animal-based fats. And I think seafoods are super healthy. So clams, oysters, crab meat, fish, you know, scallops, all of those. Really, really, really healthy foods. And then grass-fed beef, you know, organic chicken, those are all good. I'm not carnivore and I'm not vegetarian. I like a lot of cruciferous vegetables because they have sulfur, and also onions and garlic, also good sulfur sources. So I really believe in getting an adequate amount of sulfur in your diet. So I look for fermented foods, sulfur, high fat, plenty of animal-based foods, both fat and protein, and then cruciferous vegetables. And then salads. Every day I have a salad. And then vinegar, of course, is a fermented food, so I, you know, in the salad dressing. So that's kind of my formula.
I go hunting maybe once or twice a year.
Cool.
And I think that's pretty much as close as you're going to get to natural meat.
Right. Yes. And then so you eat the meat that you hunt. Is that right?
No, for sure. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's not... I mean, it's game, and I find that game tends to be quite lean.
Yes, it's true.
So I'm not a big fan of that. I also like more fat.
Right. Yeah. And I totally agree with that. I think it's saturated fat got demonized so well way back when, and people have a hard time forgetting that, you know, or they feel very skeptical if someone says, oh, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. They don't believe it, you know, because they've been brainwashed for so long to think that saturated fat is bad. And then there's all this issue about omega-3s versus omega-6, you know. Dr. Mercola has been really big on omega-6 fats are terrible lately. He's totally hung up on that, and that puzzles me also because I don't agree with him, you know. Both omega-3 and omega-6 are okay, but then saturated is the best because it can't be oxidized. And oxidized fats are bad, and they get oxidized in part because of the toxic chemical exposure, so you're kind of back there again.
I wonder if we get caught up in that analysis paralysis thing. I mean, again, like I said earlier, 1,000 years ago, they didn't know about omegas and saturated fats and whatever. They just ate naturally. Yeah. And I forget who it was now. Someone on my show said, the fewer the ingredients, the better.
Right. That's a good algorithm. If you see like a soy protein bar and it's got all these chemical ingredients, you know, don't buy it. Right. I never ate soy protein bars even when I didn't know about the toxic chemicals in the food. It just didn't seem natural, you know, so I've always gone for whole foods.
When you talk about being as natural as possible, one of the topics that's taboo is, you know, shower products like your shampoos and your soaps and things.
Yeah, those are hard. I really have a hard time with shampoos. Whenever I need shampoo, I go to the store and I look at all these things and I'm like, I don't like any of them. You know, they have a huge number of ingredients in them. I wouldn't mind, you know, just using egg or something, which I don't do. I mean, I do buy one of the sort of herbal shampoos, but I'm not happy with it, you know. And I've actually tried to wash my hair less frequently because of that, because I just don't think they're good.
Yes, but where did we get this idea that we must wash our hair every 2 or 3 days?
Yeah, right. Sometimes people do it every day, you know.
And I mean, your hair has natural stuff. And then every time you wash it, you're removing it.
I think that's probably not good. Yes, I've come to that conclusion myself, to wash your hair less frequently.
And the thing with sunglasses that I thought a lot about after you mentioned it on my show is, as I said earlier, it made me question, firstly, why am I wearing sunglasses? And number two, it made me realize what the full light spectrum actually is. And what you're doing is that you're restricting it.
Exactly. Yes. And you know, it's one of those cases where there's a simple message that seems clear to say UV light is dangerous, you know, for your eyes, and you need to protect yourself from UV light. And you can do that by buying these sunglasses. And the sunglass company, will make a lot of money if you do that. So I it's in my interest to make you believe that I'm right about that.
Stephanie, I don't know if you changed during the COVID era or if you've always been kind of on the vanguard of critical thinking, but would you go back to 2019?
Would I like to go back to 2019? What do you mean by that?
So I changed my views on a lot of things since the whole COVID thing started. It made me question everything.
Yeah.
And I would not like to go back to 2019 a result.
Because you feel you've matured because of your experience with COVID, right? In your
thinking. Yes, so that's kind of what I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, for sure. Although I was already most of the way there by then. The COVID vaccine convinced me that all vaccines are bad. I mean, I was moving in that direction already. And once the COVID vaccine came on the market, I was like done with vaccines. You know, it became very clear to me. COVID was so horrible, the COVID vaccine, and the way they forced it down our throats, it was just awful. I could not believe that it was happening even. I remember back when they had warp speed, they were just trying to develop it really fast with Trump was the president, and that was before the vaccine existed. They were going to just like roll it out on the market really fast, and mRNA technology, and I immediately started researching the mRNA technology as soon as I heard about the fact that they were developing this. And I remember at the time I thought, well, there's no way that they're going to mandate this vaccine. You know, they may put it on the market prematurely, having not studied it enough, but they won't force us to get it. They can't possibly force us to get it. And then there I was at MIT, mandated COVID vaccine. And I was so shocked, you know, and I was like, I'm not getting that vaccine. So I crafted a religious exemption. Did my best to argue a religious exemption, submitted it, and they granted it, which was really fortunate. I was afraid they wouldn't, and I thought I'd have to go on unpaid leave. They granted it on the condition that I don't show up at work. I work from home all the time. And that's why I sold my house and moved to Hawaii. So that was kind of a benefit, a side benefit of the mandate for me, was that I got to move to Hawaii, and I'm still working for MIT remotely.
That's amazing. Because I know a lot of people who lost their jobs because they fought that.
I would have if they had denied that. I'm grateful to MIT that they accepted my religious exemption request. So, yeah, I would have lost my job.
But I mean, it's sad that it came to that.
It was crazy.
What do you think was going on, Stephanie?
Well, I felt, actually, I figured out early on, I suspected that the whole point of the whole storyline was to get the mRNA technology out the door, because they were very, they had a lot of hype around the mRNA technology, you know, so the nanoparticles and this way of delivering, and they could see it as a potential for cancer therapy. They just had dollar signs in their eyes. They were like so delighted with this technology, except for the fact that it was very difficult to get it approved. Because if you studied it, you found out it had a lot of nasty problems. So if you can have an emergency situation and kind of go wink, wink, bypass all those steps and just throw it out on the market and then give it to the whole world, this gets complete buy-in if everybody's happy with it. You know, now everybody's like, oh, yeah, mRNA technology, that's fantastic. Let's get some of those cancer vaccines out there, you know. So it was an opportunity to exploit the so-called emergency situation to get that technology out the door. And they kind of succeeded, except that they've got a huge number of people like me who think it's extremely toxic, who would never go near that vaccine, and who continue to study it and continue to get even more alarmed about what they're seeing, you know?
But Stephanie, trust the science.
Right. I think a lot of people, and it's interesting actually how much I predicted this way back when the vaccine was coming out and people were all happy to get it, except for some people like me who were fighting it like crazy. I predicted that vaccine would actually set back all the vaccines as far as their willingness, people's willingness to accept them. Because parents have been brainwashed into thinking that children can't live without all those vaccines. They get like 72 different immunizations over the course of childhood. It's insane these days. The number of vaccines in the United States has gone up incredibly, probably exponentially, since 1986 when they passed that law that got the vaccine industry off the hook. For any time a vaccine is mandated for the kids in school, it doesn't matter what happens with the vaccine. The industry is not responsible. They can't get sued. And that is a big boon for the pharmaceutical industry. So they love vaccines because they can just, you know, go ahead and kill kids. It's no problem for them as far as financials are concerned, you know. And then all the disinformation, I would call it, trying to convince parents that these vaccines are so essential and, you know, and so wonderful. I mean, this idea that they're, that if you didn't get those vaccines, you'd die of smallpox, you know, or polio or diphtheria. I mean, there are all these diseases that you're going to get if you don't get those vaccines. People really got convinced that you had to have the vaccines in order to protect your child from those diseases that, in fact, can kill you. It's certainly true. But the vaccine can kill you, too. And I know that from the VAERS database, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and especially the COVID vaccine. It is extremely toxic. And that's coming out, I think. Things are changing right now. Fewer and fewer people are willing to get their seventh or eighth booster shot, you know, for COVID. People are waking up. More people are waking up. And then they're going on to question the childhood vaccines as a consequence of the COVID nightmare. And in fact, Florida has now, I'm so pleased with the state of Florida, they have dropped the mandates. I'm really eager to see how that moves forward, because they're saying, you know, they still recommend all these vaccines for the kids. And you go to your doctor and you can tell your doctor, look, I don't want my kid to have the vaccine. And that's fine. You know, you can still go to school. I mean, that is so awesome to me, because there will be parents one by one who decide, you know what, I'm just not going to vaccinate my kids, period. And we'll see what happens, you know. And so it's an experiment underway, and we will see. I mean, will they all start, you know, dying of horrible diseases? I don't think so, because I think it's more a matter of keeping your immune system healthy. And that is the sunlight. Sunlight is really great for the immune system. So get your kids out in the sun, you know, and make sure they're exercising, give them good nutrition. And they won't, if they catch measles, they're not going to die. You know, they probably won't even have a severe case as long as they've got a strong immune system. So it's more important to keep yourself healthy through natural living than it is to inject all these toxic chemicals into your body. I mean, the vaccines, all of them are toxic.
Well, I was asking you about going back to 2019. If you had asked me about childhood vaccines, like the MMR shot, if you'd asked me about that in 2019 or even 2020, I would have said, yeah, for sure, definitely. Mm-hmm. In the time that you and I spoke last to now, my son was born and he's not vaccinated.
Oh, good for you. I'm so pleased. You did the right, you made the right choice.
And in fact, I took it one step further. I didn't want him to get vitamin K, and my wife looked into it and agreed. So he didn't even get vitamin K.
Good. Yeah, because that one's got aluminum in it, I think.
And people don't even think about vitamin K. They focus on the vaccines and they forget that. I think actually in the U.S., in many states of the U.S., you can't say no to vitamin K.
Yeah, that may be. I'm not sure, but it wouldn't surprise me. And that is crazy. That is so crazy that you have to take that. You have to give your infant, you know, something like that. Again, you know,
I
natural.
Had no idea. Yeah. Well, I had no idea what the reasons behind it were. And I thought, well, it's just seems like it's a vitamin. It's just harmless. But it turns out that it has to do with the fact that most births now happen in hospital and they don't allow for the process to occur. You know, they cut the umbilical cord too quickly.
Yeah.
And so then they need a blood thickening agent.
That's very interesting. I bet you're right. Yeah, everything's rush, 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 right?
Yes. So you should wait until the blood from the mother has finished flowing.
And the umbilical cord is so important and so much, so many nutrients. I'm sure all kinds of interesting things come in that last moment before it's severed. And you certainly would want to wait until, you know, everything has happened for sure. That makes so much sense. Oh, you make a very good point there. And that may be what's triggering the problem with the vitamin K, the need for the vitamin K because of that. I like that theory. That's nice.
Well, I didn't devise it myself. I wish I could claim that, but that came from a bunch of OBGYNs that I spoke to.
Oh, that's great that they knew that. And they were willing to wait then and let everything happen, unfold naturally. Mm. That's great. That's great.
And a lot of issues perhaps later on in life could be triggered already from that moment.
Right. I know. It's so important. You know, what happens in utero also is very important. And the mother's exposures during pregnancy. And that's where I get really upset about all the vaccines that they give to pregnant women these days. They seem to think it's perfectly fine to give them all these vaccines, which are going to go directly into the fetus. You know, the placenta doesn't necessarily keep things out. And of course, any drugs the mother's taking, they're all dangerous. And of course, glyphosate exposure in utero, really bad, you know?
When my wife was pregnant, the gynae said to her, you must remember now, you must get a flu shot while
you
she's pregnant.
You must get one, right?
Yeah, yeah. And she just nodded. Mm-hmm. But when we left, she said, there's no chance that that's happening. And then guess what happened? She changed gynaes.
Oh, good for her. Oh, that's so crazy. Yeah, they have this kind of mentality that because the flu could be bad if you catch a flu while you're pregnant, which is probably true. But the thing is, if you get the vaccine, you're guaranteed to get the toxins that are in the vaccine if you take it while you're pregnant. How can that be good? You know, so you're getting a guaranteed exposure to protect you from a maybe exposure. I mean, I never get the flu, so I haven't had it for like decades. And I never got a flu shot my whole life, you know, whereas other people my age are pretty routinely every year another flu shot, you know.
So my son is 14 months old and he's never been sick. And his friends, who are more or less the same age as him, sicknesses, and most of them have been jabbed with the MMR shot.
Yeah. Well, have you seen the data? I mean, there's several papers now that have come out. Comparing vaxxed versus unvaxxed kids in the United States. And of course, some of those papers got retracted because the industry just jumps right all over you if you show the vaccines in a bad light. But the papers were stunning. There's a paper that looked at, there was one clinic that had a lot of patients over the years, and they were popular with people who didn't get their kids vaccinated because they were willing to not vaccinate. And so they had a nice collection of data for kids who had no vaccines and kids who had some vaccines and kids who got all the vaccines on schedule, you know, different groups of kids. But when they compared the kids that were totally unvaccinated with the rest of them, huge differences in things like ear infections and, various allergies and eczema, asthma, all these things that are autoimmune disease related, and ADHD and autism, all these things were much, much higher in the vaccinated group compared to the unvaccinated. They were so healthy. And, you know, they basically, and this was looking at well baby visits. I mean, they looked at sick baby visits. So basically they took the data was based on the number of visits that they showed up for with things like ear infection, instead of just showing for a checkup, you know, where they often get vaccines at the checkup, when the child was actually sick and therefore called the doctor. That's what they were looking at. Those data showed that the vaccinated kids were sick much, much more often with the ear infections and those sorts of things. They just basically had a weakened immune system because the vaccines, you know, will protect you against one disease or maybe sometimes three diseases, at the same time making your immune system generically less capable of handling everything else. That's what I think. The vaccines set you back on your innate immunity every time you get a vaccine. And so by the time you've gotten all those vaccines, your immune system is basically, you know, really, really disturbed in terms of the ability to just fight off anything that comes along.
But so are you saying that vaccines do work?
Well, they can cause you to develop antibodies. And antibodies is never a good solution, in my opinion. I think that your body develops antibodies to the antigens that are in the virus, because the innate immune system couldn't handle the disease. So if you have a severe case of measles, your body will develop antibodies to help fight it off. It's a backup system because your innate immunity is too weak to handle it. If you clear the disease naturally without having to have anything specific, your body doesn't bother to develop antibodies. But when you get a severe case of the disease, then the antibodies come into play. And they will remember that disease and then be ready to fight again if it comes again. So that's a kind of protection that is put in place in the body only for as a backup system for when the innate immune system isn't good enough to handle it. That's what's working with natural systems. But with the vaccines, you're basically forcing you to choose the antibody approach because you've bypassed all the mucosal membranes. You've got it injected into the body beyond the membranes. And so it looks like this virus has breached the barriers. And therefore, you need to get the antibodies going to protect you from this fake virus, which is actually the vaccine. It forces you to make those antibodies. It forces you to take a step that is beyond what you would normally do with innate immunity. You see what I'm trying to say here? That's a little complicated, but I believe that. The vaccines make your immune system choose the alternative pathway that normally only happens when your immune system is too weak to handle it. And then those antibodies have all kinds of risk for causing autoimmune disease because you get molecular mimicry, and these antibodies to the virus can end up attacking human proteins and causing disease. You know, and that's how you get things like eczema and asthma and even, you know, multiple sclerosis. I mean, some really nasty autoimmune rheumatoid arthritis. All these things, and inflammatory bowel, you know, have all kinds of celiac disease. There's just a huge list of autoimmune diseases that happen because the antibodies are attacking the human proteins by mistake.
Do you think COVID was a real thing?
Well, I think it was probably a lab escape. And then the question is whether it was intentional or natural. I remember going through that whole period wanting to know what is the truth here and reading all these different papers and trying to sort it out. It was a wild ride. It was so amazing to realize, finally, to become convinced that it was a lab escape. And then also, what was the lab doing? You know, so there's like layers of questions that end up you're being puzzled over, choice X or choice Y, and you don't know which one's right. So if they were working with these viruses and ended up producing this gain-of-function virus, what was the reason why they were doing that, right? Was it to try to develop a vaccine? Was it for warfare, you know, biological warfare? That's one question. You don't know the answer there. And then the fact that it was released from the lab, was that accidental or was that intentional, is another question to ask. And I don't have answers, you know, but I'm quite certain that it's not just a natural thing. It had to do with human mucking around with viruses. And we have that capability. We know how to do it, how to make viruses more toxic and, you know, more virulent. And the things that are different between the COVID, SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-CoV-1, the differences are things that are remarkably clever. I mean, the sort of thing you would think of doing if you understood the biology of it, to put in this exact sequence that would allow it, you know, to do, to, to bind to bind to the receptor, this heart, you know, the ACE2 inhibitor, ACE2 receptor, and there's a furin cleavage site. You know, there's like stuff in there that you're like, it looks like it's by design, by human design.
So then, following on from our question, what do you make of terrain theory? Do you think this validity in it?
Absolutely, I totally embrace it, for sure, and that's why I feel like you need to live a natural, healthy life to keep your immune system strong. Your immune system is so important for your health, really number one, and the way you keep it strong is by living a natural lifestyle.
You said earlier that you don't like supplements. Now, I love that you said that because I have a love-hate relationship with them. So my primary approach is a supplement is in addition to, which means that something is deficient.
Right.
So you should sort that out. So you only take supplements when you're not getting that thing in what you're eating or drinking. So
right.
Shouldn't the focus be on sorting out what's on your plate rather than taking the pill?
Absolutely. I mean, I always feel that if you feel like you're deficient in something, then go find out what foods have a lot of it and eat those, you know, just change your diet. I definitely think that's the right way to do it. And I've actually, it's interesting because supplements are very, very different. They're not the same thing. You know, you think it's the same thing. And of course, they're also out of context. If you just take a pill that's pure or something or other, you know, a pure version of a particular molecule as a pill, that's so unnatural. The way that molecule is being delivered is extremely unnatural. Like just a vitamin D pill, you know, vitamin D all by itself in pure form is crazy. As far as your natural system doesn't know how to handle that properly. And a good example is folic acid, because folic acid is terrible. It's a fortification that they require in the bread in America. I don't think you do in South Africa, but I don't know. We require folic acid and iron supplement fortification in the bread, and I think that's a really bad idea. Folic acid is a synthetic version of folate, and folate is naturally found in green vegetables and lots of other foods. So if you get a good diet, you're getting enough folate in your diet. Folic acid, normally the folate gets handled by the gut microbes and turned into methyl tetrahydrofolate, which is a very important molecule in the methylation pathways. But folic acid, the microbes don't know what to do with it. So they ship it over to the liver. And then the liver is tasked with converting it into methyl tetrahydrofolate, which takes a lot of effort for the liver and draws it away from other things that it would rather be doing. You know, so the liver is busy trying to convert this folic acid into the proper form. And often if you're taking high doses of folic acid, the liver just can't handle it all. So it just lets it go out into circulation as folic acid, which is really bad because then it binds to the folate receptors in the brain and blocks the regular folate from getting there. So you end up with a cerebral folate deficiency as a consequence of eating too much folic acid. So it's very ironic that by virtue of taking high doses of something that you think is providing you with folate, it's actually interfering with folate supply to the brain.
I remember when my wife was pregnant, there was a big discussion around folic acid and being pregnant. Apparently, it's not good.
Well, it's interesting because the big reason for it was to protect from neural tube defects. The idea was, if you don't have enough folate, then the brain of the infant can develop incorrectly, and you can get some really nasty, lethal effects if the child is not viable. If there's not enough folate, so that's why you think, we got to make sure they get plenty of folic acid, and so they pretty routinely encourage women to take folic acid as a supplement when they're pregnant. And it's a bad idea. You know, again, it's that you need it. They need the natural form. And people don't appreciate that. Even the doctors don't appreciate that.
Now, the counter argument, and I've had this many times, is, well, we don't get enough of these nutrients in our food. Our food is already deficient.
Yeah,
the soil is deficient. So therefore, we do need to take supplements, particularly...
Yeah,
particularly vitamin D if you live in Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't enough sun.
Well, it's a good point. But again, I would say eat a lot of foods that contain vitamin D because you can, you know, like as seals, for example, up north, you know, they've got very little sun, but they eat a lot of seal fat, which has lots of vitamin D in it. And even the fat in fish has vitamin D. And animal-based fats have vitamin D, like I mean, if the cow is hanging out in the sunlight, which it might not be, but yeah, right. I mean, there have been a lot of people talking about mineral deficiency, and they maybe have a valid point. I suspect they do. And part of that is glyphosate, because glyphosate binds to minerals and makes them unavailable. I remember the first lecture I heard on glyphosate. Glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup, and that's my book, and Roundup, and it's pervasive in the environment. In the United States, it's all over the food supply. It's really scary. I've had friends, my friend Zen Honeycutt, who founded the organization called Moms Across America, and she's had lots of testing done of different kinds of foods. She had her moms go collect school lunch foods and ship them off and get them tested. 95% were positive for glyphosate. And she had fast food, you know, from the fast food restaurants. 100% were contaminated with glyphosate. So it is all over the food supply in this country. The government thinks it's perfectly safe, so they don't worry about it. They don't bother to test even. So that's really, really frustrating for me.
Why is it being used?
Why is it being used? It kills weeds. It's very effective in agriculture to make your foods cheap because you don't have to hire people to pull the weeds out. You can just spray. And they have all these crops that are engineered to be resistant to glyphosate through genetic engineering. And they can just spray the crop with the glyphosate, doesn't die. And they even use it at harvest. They spray wheat, barley, oats, chickpeas, garbanzo beans at harvest, right before harvest, with glyphosate as a drying agent. And then those foods have really high levels of glyphosate in them. They're non-GMO, but they're highly contaminated with glyphosate.
How do you get around it, though? I mean, how does agriculture do its
thing? Well, that is the huge question. That's what we need to work on. I feel like we're smart enough, we should be able to do it. And one possibility, I think, is technology, because there's these fancy tractors coming out that are, robotic tractors that can drive themselves. They can have vision capabilities. They can recognize which of the plants are weeds and which ones aren't. They can carry some boiling water and just, selectively kill the weed. I mean, I think it's possible. They can run on solar energy. They have solar panels. They're producing these fancy tractors. One's called the Monarch that I'm aware of, that maybe can help to alleviate the problem of weeds without having to get people out there to pull them, because human resources are very expensive, and that's the big issue, I think, that you don't have to hire. We have these mega farms now that are pure corn, or pure soy. That's the only monocrop, and it's a GMO engineered, so then you can just spray the glyphosate. The weeds go away. It's very convenient, It makes food cheap.
We should be not doing that sort of monoculture mega farming.
Oh, I totally agree. Absolutely. I really push for the small family farm concept and just growing a lot of different things and even maybe not worrying so much about the weeds, Because the weeds actually help to enrich the soil. I mean, they have some benefits. And so you could just kind of be more relaxed about the weeds and just harvest the crop and have a lot of different things growing, fruit trees and things like that. It's doable. I mean, in many small family farms, they don't grow, corn and soy. They grow lots of different vegetables and stuff. And they may have some cows. Well, I was just going to say this whole issue of refurbishing the soil, not just organic, not just certified organic, but regenerative agriculture is really important to try to, because the soil is really sick right now. That's one thing about the chemicals. And as I said, glyphosate depletes the metals. In fact, I talked about this talk, and I didn't quite finish it, because Don Huber presented data that he had collected showing that plants, food crops that were exposed to glyphosate had way lower levels of all kinds of critical minerals, like magnesium and zinc and manganese and copper. All these things were way down, even sulfur were way down compared to the crop that was not grown in the presence of glyphosate. So even the GMO crops, they have this gene that protects them so they don't die. But that doesn't mean they still aren't affected in terms of the minerals, that they don't take up as many minerals as they should. And then when you eat that plant, you're not getting as many minerals as you would normally get. And that is an issue. And you could even argue that that's such a big issue that you need to take mineral supplements,
What does glyphosate do to you?
Oh, gosh. It does so many things. It's unbelievable. I believe that it's the primary cause of the epidemic we're seeing today in America and a long list of diseases, including especially obesity, diabetes, autism, ADHD, pancreatic cancer, thyroid cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, liver disease, kidney disease. I mean, there's a huge list. and liver cancer, kidney cancer, even probably breast cancer. I mean, just it's an endocrine disruptor. It's Parkinson's disease. I mean, it's amazing. All these diseases are going up, and dementia, you know, Alzheimer's, all of them are going up dramatically over time in this country. We're getting so sick, and we don't seem to care. The government doesn't seem to mind. And well, lately it does mind, right? There's a big deal with the new government. I'm really appreciative of RFK Jr. He's really putting out a message that, you know, we're sick and we need to figure out why we need to fix it. And that gives me hope. I really am very excited about potentially seeing some changes in the government in terms of paying attention to these problems and really doing the research to get to the bottom of it. But I think the bottom of it has a lot to do with glyphosate. It's considered to be perfectly safe for humans. It's pervasive. People use it carelessly in their yards to kill their dandelions, even when the kids are out playing. They just don't know that it's not safe. And in my book, I talk about its insidious cumulative mechanism of toxicity that has to do with its role as an analog of glycine. I think it's a really unique property of this chemical. It is a glycine molecule. Glycine is an amino acid. It's the smallest amino acid. It goes into the proteins. You know, it's one of the coding amino acids. Very, very important in many different proteins, like essential. If you have a glycine in a particular spot, and if there's a mutation, it gets changed into alanine, then that protein doesn't work anymore. So there's like really many, many proteins that have critical glycines. And I think the glyphosate is actually getting into the proteins by mistake in place of the glycine all over your body. And certain proteins are very susceptible to disruption if glyphosate does that. And so and there's many proteins that glyphosate has been shown to suppress that have highly conserved glycines at places where they bind phosphate. And that's sort of what I think is a critical situation in which glyphosate is going to cause trouble. And so my book talks about all these different proteins that are associated with these various diseases that are going up dramatically, exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage. It's a beautiful puzzle to put together, and it works really well. The industry, you know, they did studies in which they tried 1,000 different chemicals that were tweaks on glyphosate. They were looking for something else that might do the same thing, might be as good as glyphosate, something different, because they always want to have some new chemical they can patent, you know. And they looked at 1,000 different things, and none of them worked. None of them worked anywhere near as well as glyphosate did. And none of them were amino acid analogs of glycine. So that's the critical thing with glyphosate that makes it so special.
So if I'm driving past a farm and I see one of those planes flying over the crops spraying that stuff, is it most likely that?
I hope you don't have the top down when you're driving. Yeah, people have gotten it. I have gotten an email from people who, like someone who was walking her dog when they sprayed, and they basically got hit by the spray, and then she and her dog both got really sick after that. I mean, it's really sad. It can be that simple, that if you just have one accident, it can ruin your life.
But then why does the government not care, or is that on purpose?
I don't know. That's the million-dollar question. I think they've been convinced by the industry that we can't live without glyphosate. Like, it's so essential for us to feed our nation that if we didn't have glyphosate, what would we do? We'd all starve, you know? That's the message that the industry conveys. And I think the government individuals tend to believe it. They're worried that if they tried to ban glyphosate, we'd all starve. And they may have a point, because we haven't figured out how to do without it. You know, we've gotten complacent. We'd have to hire a lot of people to pull weeds, or we'd have to have a great decrease in yield, you would think, you know, if you're not dealing with the weeds. So you need alternative solutions. And that's why I think this Monarch, for example, these tractors could be one way. And there's also people are trying to develop natural herbicides that could kill the weeds without harming humans, you know, because we don't have any good choices for herbicides. People say, well, maybe they'll just get rid of glyphosate, then they'll use 2,4-D or dicamba or glufosinate. Those are all supposedly much more toxic than glyphosate. So it's kind of like out of the frying pan into the fire, you know. If you ban glyphosate and just switch over to some of these others, atrazine, they're all bad. I think you can't use chemical herbicides, period, on crops if you want a healthy population. That's what I believe.
It reminds me of people switching sugar for fake sugar.
Oh, I know. That's another nightmare. Oh, gosh, yes.
Oh, well, it's not sugar. Well, no, it's not. It's like xylitol or whatever, but it's a chemical.
Oh, absolutely. I have never taken any of those sweeteners that are not natural in my whole life. I mean, unless by accident someone gave me something that I didn't realize had, you know. By choice, I'm always very careful not to eat any of those alternative sweeteners that are supposed to be calorie free and that sort of thing.
The people around me seem to have gone back to how things were. How short are people's memories?
I know. Actually, it surprises me that there aren't more people who are aware of how bad the vaccines are. Because to me, it's so obvious that they're not. They work for a short while. The COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccines. There's a period right after the vaccine where you're more vulnerable to COVID than you were before, during the period when your body's adjusting to the vaccine. And then once you get the antibodies after maybe a month, right? You've got a short window of time where you're protected. Like if you get the disease during that time, it'll be milder. I admit that it does actually protect you from severe disease because it's made you make those antibodies. But those antibodies can really cause you a lot of trouble in other ways, like through autoimmune disease. And then the vaccine, actually, if you keep on getting, so then you have to get another booster because it runs out. That's the really horrible thing. It runs out. So now every 6 months, you know, you've got another shot. And every time you get one, you're putting more poison into your body. And eventually, you just, it really hurts your health in big ways. And obviously, the heart problems that we're seeing, and even neurodegenerative problems, thrombosis, you know, the lungs can get a blood clot, and you can have pulmonary embolism. I mean, there's all kinds of scary things that are happening in response to those vaccines. And I don't understand why people still get them. And people who have had, you know, six or seven boosters and still going at it is just crazy.
But what makes mRNA so dangerous?
Yeah, well, that's a long story, but it's the engineering is quite sophisticated and clever. Again, in ways to try to fool the body, but they've figured out that the history of developing these vaccines goes way back. They've been working on them for decades, back to the 1990s, and they had this idea that you could give the person the machinery to make the toxic protein that you want them to be exposed to. So you give them, instead of giving them the spike protein, you give them the code for the spike protein in the form of mRNA, which is a very fragile molecule. So then the big question was, how do I keep the body from breaking down the mRNA before it manages to get turned into protein? That was a big stumper for them. And they had to go through a lot of studies and designing different things, and they finally figured out to hide it inside a lipid nanoparticle, you know. So now you have the lipid nanoparticle, which is also all by itself is toxic. They don't admit that, but it's true. You know, the lipid nanoparticles are dangerous by themselves, even without the contents. But the mRNA, it's hiding inside the lipid nanoparticle, so that the machinery that would break it down can't get to it. But then they also redesigned the mRNA to make it really, really sturdy. And one thing they did was to take all the uridines and turn them into methyl pseudouridine, which is a very unnatural form of a messenger RNA molecule. And when they did that, it became the enzymes that would normally break it apart don't know how to do it anymore. Because just like when you put glyphosate instead of glycine to mess things up, well, when they put those methyl pseudouridines in there, the enzyme can't break it down the way it would normally do. So the mRNA sticks around for a long time. They need it to do that so we can make the protein. They want to make it to make enough protein so that the immune cells see the protein, get the antibodies going. So they were working really hard on keeping it from breaking down. They also put things on the ends that would help to keep it from breaking down. The whole obsession with, let's keep that mRNA alive as long as we can. And then they succeeded wildly, almost beyond their imagination, because they're seeing now messenger RNA still around a month later, even maybe 2 months later, and spike protein still around 6 months later or even longer. And I don't know how that spike protein is surviving, and whether that's because the mRNA got converted to DNA, which has also been shown recently in papers, that the mRNA gets converted into DNA. And once that happens, the DNA can carry the code forever, and it can get converted back into RNA, back into protein at any time. And so you've got these immune cells that are senescent immune cells, possibly carrying around DNA that is codes for the spike protein, and that could survive for years. In theory. So there's some things that are theoretical. There's some things that have been shown experimentally. There's also DNA contamination in the vaccines. There's all kinds of things that are fishy about these vaccines. And to think that that they're harmless is just ludicrous.
And then at one stage they were saying, well, it's designed to stay in the region
of the injection. And that's certainly not true. And they've shown that experimentally as well, that it gets into the lymph system. It travels to, and even it goes to the spleen, it goes to the liver. It even goes to the ovaries, you know, the reproductive organs. And everywhere it goes, it causes trouble.
How did humans survive for so many thousands of years?
I know.
Up until 200 years ago.
Right, I know. We didn't have any of these resources, and now we're creating all these monster things that I think could do us in, actually. I'm concerned that we may not survive as a species for very much longer, because we're really hurting the reproductive system. And we're also, so many kids are sick, like autism. The autism rates are through the roof here in this country. And at some point, as a young mother, as a young woman, you may really question the wisdom of getting pregnant, because there's this high risk of having an autistic child, which will completely change your life in ways you don't want, you know? To have the responsibility of bringing up an autistic child would be such a burden that you might say, you know what, I think I just won't have kids. I think that's going to be happening, or maybe it is already happening with the young people today, that there's too much risk involved in not producing a healthy child, that you just decide to bypass that whole part of life and just do without, you know. And then if enough people do that, we don't reproduce ourselves. All it takes is a reproductive rate that's under replacement and time, and we'll run out, you know.
But that stat seems to apply for almost every country now.
Yeah, so many countries are down below the reproductive rate at this point. And it looks like to me it's just going to chase us out of the earth, because we'll just shrink in population over time. Until we are no more. I mean, there'll be too few of us to be able to carry on.
The amount of women struggling to fall pregnant is also...
Oh, I know. That's the other thing. One is just choosing not to have a child because it's too risky to have a bad child, a child that's defective. And two is not being able to get pregnant. That's also a huge problem. The infertility clinics are really thriving in this country. And people are also, you know, young people are harvesting their eggs and putting them in a deep freeze, right? A lot of women are doing that, the young women. They're like, okay, I don't want to have a kid right now. I'm busy, you know. I'll just harvest my eggs and put them into the freezer. And then when I'm 36, 37, I'll pull them out and get pregnant. And people are doing that, you know, sort of reassuring that they won't be without children in the long run. And then finding out that all those eggs, none of those eggs are viable. And so they end up, you know, no children. I mean, that's happening too. But
give me a nugget of wisdom.
Well, I mean, as you know, my whole thing is just live a natural life. I think that's so key. Just to think, if this is not natural, don't do it, for everything that you might think about doing. Only do it if it's natural. And that's been my philosophy all my life. And I think it's worked well for me, because I feel like I'm very healthy, especially considering my age. You know, I'm at that age when people start to fall apart, and so far so good. So we hope that'll continue, but we don't know.
Well, you also live in Hawaii. Maybe that's also another key to success. Hawaii.
Well, I do love Hawaii. It is so beautiful and so much sunlight, you know, and great weather. So you always want to be outdoors. I spend a lot of time outdoors. I was just figuring out, probably 4 or 5 hours every day outdoors. You have great weather there. It's actually really, really nice. There's a lot to be said about Cape Town. I think it's a great place. I mean, it has some issues with the black-white problem, but...
Oh, no, it's huge.
That's a huge problem, and the crime rates are a bit high, and the government may not be perfect, but but the place is beautiful. Table Mountain, you know, the ocean.
Yeah,
it's really nice.
There is a sense of freedom though in all the chaos.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Stephanie, how can my audience get your book and will follow your work in general?
Yeah, well, my book Toxic Legacy would be something to read if you want to learn about glyphosate.
It's on Amazon.
On Amazon, yes. Uh-huh. And then my webpage is stephaniesenef.net. There's some information there, but I have a lot of published papers.
Yes, you've been with MIT forever.
Yes, ever since undergraduate. Yes, I got my undergraduate degree in biology, actually, at MIT many, many years ago. And then a master's, EE, and PhD degrees in electrical engineering and computer science. And then most of my career was spent writing code, computer code, to help computers learn how to communicate with humans using natural language. That was my career path until 2007, when that was when I sort of got interested in autism and wanted to figure out what was causing the autism epidemic. And that's the rest of it is history. I mean, I've basically gotten completely back into biology, had a really good time learning about biology the last two decades. And I feel like I'm really making headway in understanding what the issues are and why we're so unhealthy and all of this. And how to fix it is, I sort of know how to fix it, but I don't know how to make it happen, you know, because we've got so much resistance to where we need to go from industries and so and also governments. It's just like really difficult to know the path. I think I know what the path should be, but I don't know how to make it happen.
I actually forgot that you were so connected to computer science, and I will get grilled if I don't ask you, even just very quickly, your views on AI.
Oh, I know. AI is actually really, really interesting right now. And I'm amazed at how quickly the technology I was working on has matured to the point where it's useful. You know, I actually never thought it would be useful back when I was developing these systems that could communicate using speech. I just thought it was way too hard and it would never happen. And I almost lost, you know, got out of a job because it worked so well. The industry took over and it was hard for me to figure out what I could do to improve upon what the industry was already doing at the point when it became commoditized. And now it's just unbelievable, the AI, the sophistication of AI and what it can do, the ChatGPT kind of thing, you know, all the AI chatbots, unbelievable. And of course, they make mistakes, but they can be very useful to help anybody learn something. Even you have to be wary of the mistakes, but you can learn so much just by chatting with one of these devices. And then, of course, they're taking over on so many jobs, even jobs like writing code. You know, it's pretty amazing that the computer can do a pretty good job of writing code. You just have to provide it with a description of what you want, and it can, in whatever coding language you want, and it can come up with code, and then you can just kind of, you might have to tweak it. You know, it might not be perfect, but it's a very different kind of job from what it was when I wrote code, where you had to do it all by hand, you know? And so even in my lab, there's discussion around what is the future of our field. You know, if you're getting a degree in computer science today, back in the day, you were sort of like, if you could code, that was really good. You know, you're a really good coder. That's probably not the case anymore. And you sort of need to readjust to a different way of writing code, a different way of writing a novel even, you know, that you can have the computer help you write the novel. Even maybe create the plot. I mean, and of course, envision things as well, like in advertising, being able to create images for advertising using Midjourney, for example, is pretty amazing. And it creates these images that are not copyrighted. So that's going to cause all kinds of problems with artists, you know, and what is the value of the artist now that the computer can do the same thing? Many, many open questions about what's going to happen with various career paths that used to be a sure thing, and now we just don't know how much of that of what we humans used to do can be done better by the computer, and to what extent will that cause career paths to fail. That I think it's a very difficult time to graduate from college and then to think about what am I going to do next, you know, and to know what's the best choice for a career path that's going to be durable despite all this that's happening with the AI. So really interesting times in that respect.
Do you agree with Elon Musk that it's an existential threat?
I think I probably do. Yes. We're at a time when there are so many problems, you know. We could maybe encourage people to go buy a piece of land and grow some organic food. You know, that might be the safest bet, I think, as far as a career path at this point.
Okay, well, on that note, Stephanie Seneff, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you. It was fun. Thanks.